it's a big group on Wednesday nights, and I love it. I look forward to completing 1 Samuel, even though we've so enjoyed our time in it. Look forward to seeing what you have and what happened with David and what you might speak to us. But that's not even next week, that's the following week. But for tonight, the lessons that we need to learn and what we need to glean, even again, just reading through it and some comments along the way to have a better understanding of your word, that helps. And it's so good for our spirit inside of us. And Holy Spirit, as you connect with our spirit and speak to our spirit and what your word does and how that begins to transform us and what that does in combating the flesh and what that does in strengthening the spirit and our spiritual man, the inward person, the spiritual person. Lord, we need to be strengthened there. I know this is a common prayer in so many of our prayer times and prayer meetings and individual prayers. Like in these days, we need to be strong for the things of you. There's so many things that would distract. So just even a Wednesday evening set aside for your glory, for our growth, our maturity, our edification. We thank you that we can be here. Please do speak to our hearts. In Jesus' precious name, amen. All right, 1 Samuel chapter 29. It says, "Then the Philistines gathered together all their armies at Aphek, and the Israelites encamped by a fountain which is in Yetzriel. And the lords of the Philistines passed in review by hundreds and by thousands, but David and his men passed in review at the rear with Achish." So what's important here, of course, is that we kind of took a pause in chapter 28. If you were here last week, remember this. Go back to chapter 28 for just a moment. Verse 1, "Now it happened in those days that the Philistines gathered their armies together for war to fight with Israel. And Achish said to David, 'You assuredly know that you will go out with me to battle, you and your men.' So David said to Achish, 'Surely you know that your servant, what your servant can do.' And Achish said to David, 'Therefore I will make you one of my chief guardians forever.'" Then verse 3 down to the end of the chapter was Saul being Saul, kind of going in the wrong direction and so confused, so lost and just looking for something, looking for answers and looking in the wrong direction. So that was a bit of a pause there in that section, and that finally gets us to arrive here to actually the outset of this battle. And I think it's important before we even touch on this, just the condition of David here and even what Achish recognized. I just read it there in verse 2 of chapter 28, where he says to David, Achish, this lord of the Philistines, this king of the Philistines, "Therefore I will make you one of my chief guardians forever." And if you remember from the end of chapter 27, just trying to set the table here, the end of chapter 27, verse 12, "So Achish believed David, saying, 'He has made his people Israel utterly abhor him, therefore he will be my servant forever.'" So he believes that about David. Then two verses later, here into chapter 28, he actually directly says, "You're going to be my servant. I'll make you one of my chief guardians forever." He really believes that he has David. Almost, what's that expression? That's an odd one, but he has him in his pocket, right? He's mine. That guy's going to serve me forever. He's just made himself look so bad to his own people. He has nowhere else to go, and he's got this great fighting force. He's mine. He's mine. And David just so off track from all of the disappointments that have worked against him, and he's not worked against those things. So that gets us to chapter 29. Again, the Philistines gathered together all their armies at Aphek, and the Israelites encamped by a fountain which is in Jezreel. And the lords of the Philistines passed in review by hundreds and by thousands, but David and his men passed in review at the rear with Achish. And then, verse 3 of chapter 29, the princes of the Philistines said, "What are these Hebrews doing here?" I wonder what their tone of voice was like. "Well, what's this?" I don't know what, if they would have said, like, "What are you thinking, Achish?" And Achish said to the prince of the Philistines, "Is this not David, the servant of Saul, king of Israel, who has been with me these days or these years? And to this day I have found no fault in him since he defected to me." So kind of put it in these two different categories. If you're one of the princes of the Philistines, are you right? Like, there's no way this group of Hebrews is really going to join with us, our sworn enemies, to fight against their countrymen, their brethren. This is not going to happen. But there's Achish or Achish that would say, the dude's been with me forever. Like, he's mine. I really believe he's my servant. You guys have nothing to worry about. And there's David just kind of, you know, in the rear of this review, this whole parade of the soldiers that would be ready or readying themselves for battle, and like, try not to say anything, just do the best you can here. And this is interesting, isn't it? And we're going to see this in this section tonight. You're not sure, are you? Like, who's right? Is it the princes of the Philistines? Like, there's no way. There's no way he's really with us. There's no way he's going to turn on his own people. Really? Just how much everything that David has endured, and we'll come back to that in just a moment, but there's also Achish or Achish that would say, no, the guy's been with me. And this is an interesting place for David, that we can say it both ways, that Achish is now in the place of defending David, and David in the place of being defended by Achish, this Philistine lord. And the irony of that, typically on any Sunday school or whatever, like David and Goliath, right? Like the great Philistine, he got him. And now it's David and the Philistines together getting ready for war against David's own people. Like, where's David? That we haven't had any indication that he's going to turn one way or the other. And so the difficulty with all of this, and we talked about it so much last week, is the importance of keeping your heart with all diligence, for out of it flow the issues of life. And what's David been in this situation? Well, back up to verse 1 of chapter 27, right? We talked about this last week. David said in his heart, now I shall perish someday by the hand of Saul. There is nothing better for me than I should speedily escape to the land of the Philistines, and Saul will despair of me to seek me any more in that part, in any part of Israel, and so I shall escape out of his hand. He's just saying in his heart, there's no way I'm going to win it. It's basically hopeless. And then we get to this war, and there's this argument about what to do with David. So verse 4 of chapter 29. But the princes of the Philistines were angry with him, with Achish, not so much with David. And so the princes of the Philistines said to him, make this fellow return, that he may go back to the place which you have appointed for him, that's Ziklag, right? And do not let him go down with us to battle, lest in the battle he become our adversary. For with what could he reconcile himself to his master, if not with the heads of these men? Like, that would be a perfect opportunity, and you can understand their concern. And then they said this, they give this reminder to Achish, is this not David? Of whom they sang to one another in dances, saying, Saul has slain his thousands, and David his 10,000. Like, you can understand their concern. Achish, though, he's convinced this guy's mine. Verse 6, Achish called David and said to him, surely as the Lord lives, don't miss that, and I'm sure any of your translations, the Lord there, all caps. That's the covenant name of the Jewish people with the Lord their God, Yahweh. Surely, as Yahweh lives, you have been upright, and you're going out and you're coming in with me in the army is good in my sight. For to this day, I have not found evil in you since the day of your coming to me. Nevertheless, the Lord's do not favor you. So therefore, verse 7, return now and go in peace so that you may not displease the lords of the Philistines. So this is now the second time that he says this, Achish, about David. Notice again, verse 3. The very end of the verse as he's speaking to the other princes of the Philistines. To this day I've not found any fault in him since he defected to me. This is really interesting here in verse 6 and then into verse 7. David, of course, is running low on real estate, as in, what's his place in the world? Where is he supposed to go? And maybe a better question would be, who are his friends, or what's his community? Because he has the city of Ziklag, but what am I supposed to do? Where am I supposed to be? Just a place to occupy himself and to live his life. Is neither friend nor foe that was really sticking with him other than Achish. And Achish's language, again, so interesting, as the Lord lives. But none of what, and I hope you caught this, none of what Achish believes about David is really true. You remember this from earlier in chapter 27, David would go on these little raiding parties and just kill everybody. And Achish is thinking, this guy's been great. He's been a real asset to me in my, you know, my fighting force. I love this guy, David. I'm so sorry about this. But David had him duped in that sense, and he had covered his tracks well by just killing everyone. So it's hard to know what to think. Where Achish, in terms of, how do you even say this? Like, in terms of being a Philistine, is he the more honorable guy here? Seems like it. And at what point does this get really scary in our Christianity, when the more honorable person in the conversation isn't the believer? There's just not much from David here. And super strange at this point that, like, when's the last time we've really heard any mention of the Lord? There's a little bit in the odd conversation in chapter 28, but this is not coming from David here. This is coming from Achish, the Philistine. So not much for prayer to be found here. We're not hearing much about the Lord, again, except ironically from this Philistine Lord. And then I think what's further, maybe telling is the right word, telling about David, as Achish says to him, just sends him home, return now and go in peace, that you may not displease the lords of the Philistines. Like, what's the big concern for David? You don't want to displease the lords of the Philistines. This is David that was chopping off the head of Goliath, right? And like wondering, why are we not fighting with you? We can take these guys. And now he's like, man, I can't make anybody happy. He's just so out of sorts, and it seems like a concern to him. And Achish says it, but you wonder if David's thinking the same thing. Can't fight with the enemy, can't fight alongside the enemy, and can't fight against his own people. Just go home, David. What's being said here? You're no good, you're no help to anyone. Like, go home, and I guess this is the thing, is what I mean, like, no place in the world. Go home and do what? Go home and just go to Ziklag and just live. But what am I supposed to do? This is David, anointed king, now living with the Philistines. That's nice. He's got this little city and he's been keeping himself busy for like the last roughly a year and a half. But what am I supposed to be? None of what he's doing is in line with who he is. Notice his response in verse 8 here in chapter 29 to Achish. David said to Achish, "But what have I done?" And you wonder about his tone of voice here. "And to this day, what have you found in your servant as long as I have been with you, that I may not go and fight against the enemies of my lord, the king?" And my lord Achish, your enemy would be King Saul, and why can't I go and help you? I've been serving so faithfully. This is, maybe it's just me, and I'm going to say it in these terms, my opinion. You do whatever you want with the text. My opinion here, it seems like David's disappointed. And maybe I have a different opinion. There's different ways you could read it. I'm not sure how else. But just from my reading of it, my understanding, he seems disappointed. It's not, I don't read it like David's going, "Whoo, well, that's good. I don't have to go fight. And that's good. I can just go home and let them deal with it." He seems disappointed, unless he's really trying to sell this whole thing. Don't know. But here's what I also believe about it. No matter where David might be with this, could this not be perhaps and most likely the Lord working behind the scenes to both get David out of this, and what's even greater than getting him out of this? Get his attention a little bit. Like, a year and a half has passed and there's just not much of anything that David would is on record here concerning his relationship with the Lord. So, I don't want to go home. You got to go home. Verse 9, Achish answered and said to David, "I know that you are as good in my sight as an angel of God. Nevertheless, the princes of the Philistines have said, 'He shall not go up with us to battle.' Now, therefore, rise early in the morning with your master's servants who have come with you, and as soon as you're up early in the morning and have light, depart." So they're all, you know, in camp. They're ready to go to battle. And so verse 11, David and his men rose early to depart in the morning to return to the land of Philistines. And the Philistines went up to Jezreel. Seems like a great chance to return home, not to Ziklag, but back across the border to fight with his people against these Philistine lords. He just goes home. "So I'm just going to go home." again, is this a wake-up call for David? God working behind the scenes. And I think part of the behind-the-scenes part and part of the getting David's attention would be sparing David from shedding the blood of his own brethren. I mean, how's that going to be when the song goes from Saul has slain his thousands and David is his 10,000s? Then we're going to add a little bridge to that song that says, except for the time that he turned on us, right? And now he's killed 10,000s of his own people. And now he's the king? Now he rules over us, at least the ones that he left alive. Like, it's confusing, right? Like, what do you do with David? And I don't want to get too overlapped into Romans, but you start to see like the Romans chapter 7 stuff with like fighting against the flesh and the spirit, and like, where are you in your Christian life? And sometimes, I know we've talked about this, I've referenced this, sometimes when you're in the book of Genesis, it's Jacob, and sometimes Jacob is Israel, and sometimes Israel is Jacob, and like, who's who, and how are you doing? Like, it depends on the day, right? It should be a little more consistency. And David, how are you doing at this time in life? Not great. Not great. And the Lord seems to be sparing him by just go home. Chapter 30. Now it happened when David and his men came to Ziklag on the third day that the Amalekites had invaded the south and Ziklag and attacked Ziklag and burned it with fire. So the Amalekites kind of sensing the opportunity here. The Philistines are, this is further up north, so they've left this undefended and now's our time to strike. Let's go. So they go and they burn it with fire. And verse 2, they had taken captive the women and those who were there from small to great. They did not kill anyone but carried them away and went their way. So now they've got hostages. So David and his men came to the city and there it was burned with fire and their wives, their sons, and their daughters had been taken captive. And then David and the people who were with him, these are warriors, they lifted up their voices and wept, and they wept until they had no more power to weep. When it rains, it pours. It is pouring for David right now. It's an interesting side note here in verse 3. They had taken them captive. And verse 2 as well. They did not kill anyone. This is an unexpected kind of almost plot twist. What had David done to kind of cover his tracks? Killed everybody. The Amalekites here are more merciful to the women and children than David was. Like, this doesn't feel comfortable coming out of my mouth. It shouldn't feel comfortable landing in your ears. It shouldn't feel comfortable reading this and comparing it and considering it. So here's all these men just weeping until they have no more strength to weep. You ever been there? In some kind of great loss? You can understand this for them. And David's two wives, Ahinoam the Jezreelitess and Abigail the widow of Nabal the Carmelite, had been taken captive. It just must have seemed to David that all was lost. All was lost. Almost could it get any worse? Yep, verse 6. Now David was greatly distressed, for the people spoke of stoning him, because the soul of all the people was grieved, every man for his sons and his daughters. But David strengthened himself in the Lord his God. This is really important here in verse 6. The first part, of course, is hard to read, that his men are now contemplating and having conversations about turning on him and killing him. But how else were they to feel? You know, they had followed him everywhere. This is their great leader. And everything they had was there in Ziklag. Everyone they had was in Ziklag. And now, you know, imagine this as they left and on the third day trying to return back to the city, you had to see like just the smoke billowing up in the distance, like, oh, I wonder what's going on. Do you ever see that? Like, man, there's a fire somewhere, and you get closer, and like, wow, there's the fire. And they had to imagine this and see this, and everything they had, they put everything into following David. And now their families are gone, their city. And the whole way of following David had been tough. Like, everything had been tough for them. And now, even the dual blessing of home and family for these men is lost. I think you can understand where they talked about, we're done with David. We're done. And again, it's like, could there be any more of a low point for David? He has nothing in the world, no place. His city that was given to him by the Philistines, ironically, is burned to the ground, destroyed. His wives, a whole other conversation, like both of them, gone. And now, how much are you hearing? Like, so they want to kill me. Where do you turn? That's the end of verse 6, isn't it? But David strengthened himself in the Lord his God. The first part of the verse is tough, but the second part, it would seem that the Lord is just allowing him to get to this place. There is no more room for him to run. Like, no more runway. It's like, David, you can go no further. Here you are. And the Lord is not afraid to do that. You kind of both hate that and love that. Like, that the Lord would just add that pressure. What's the first part of the word pressure? To press. It's almost like that wine press. If he needs to just add that extra pressure to press a little bit harder to get you to the place where you're just so broken, so he could say, good, now you'll turn to me. Good. I think about this passage every so often where Jesus talks about, you know, you can fall on the rock and be broken, or have the rock fall on you and be crushed to powder, kind of thing. Like, there's you and there's the rock, and you're on one side or the other. And it's one thing to be broken, another thing to be pulverized, but this is this breaking that God allows in David. And why? Because ultimately this but he strengthened himself in the Lord his God. And I'm thinking about Paul the Apostle in Acts chapter 27 on that ship that's bound for Rome, and that terrible storm. And you might remember the passage there where finally, as they're just throwing everything overboard, and ultimately they throw hope overboard, because it says all hope that we would be saved was finally given up. Like, we have our bucket of hope. We don't need that either. Just pitch that overboard. There's just no hope remaining. We'll see the work of hope in Romans chapter 8 over the next few Sundays. But here, you see what it looks like when hope is gone. And not unlike despair, hopelessness is such a powerful tool for ill. All the events of the past several chapters, all the loss for David, all the times that the king has tried to kill him. Samuel, do you remember this important little detail? Samuel's dead. He's been on the run now. And even his enemies don't trust him, or at least enough they can just say, just go home. You can just do that. But again, as they approach this city and that plume of black smoke, it spoke of greater loss and too weak to cry anymore. No tears left to cry. David finally looks to the Lord his God for strength. But here's a great question. Why would God oblige? Why would God listen to him? Because the Lord's in the business of listening. He's the God who hears. Because of his character, he's rich in mercy, and his grace is ever overflowing to those who would call to him in sincerity and in truth. If you're a note taker, just for the sake of time, no, we've got time. Psalm 31. We've got a few minutes here for this. We've got a few minutes for more Bible. We're not given any other detail about this. In other words, there's no title to this officially inspired in the scriptures, Psalm 31, but I get the sense that this might have pertained to this time in David's life when he strengthened himself in the Lord. Psalm 31, I'll just try to quickly read it. It's to the chief musician. It's a psalm of David. He says, "In you, O Lord, I put my trust. Let me never be ashamed. Deliver me in your righteousness. Bow down your ear to me. Deliver me speedily. Be my rock of refuge, a fortress of defense to save me. For you are my rock and my fortress. Therefore, for your name's sake, lead me and guide me. Pull me out of the net which they have secretly laid for me. For you are my strength. Into your hand I commit my spirit. You have redeemed me, O Lord God of truth. I have hated those who regard useless idols, but I trust in the Lord. I will be glad and rejoice in your mercy, for you have considered my trouble. You have known my soul in adversities. and have not shut me up into the hand of my enemy, of the enemy. You have set my feet in a wide place. Have mercy on me, O Lord, for I am in trouble. And notice this, my eye wastes away with grief. Yes, my soul and my body. Like at this point here in 1 Samuel, he doesn't have any tears left to cry. My life is spent with grief and my years with sighing. My strength fails because of my iniquity and my bones waste away. I'm a reproach among all my enemies, but especially among my neighbors. If this is that time in his life, his neighbors want to kill him. I'm repulsive to my acquaintances. Those who see me outside flee from me. I am forgotten like a dead man out of mind. I am like a broken vessel, for I hear the slander of many. Fear is on every side. While they take counsel together against me, they scheme to take away my life. But as for me, I trust in you, O Lord. I say, you are my God. My times are in your hand. Deliver me from the hand of my enemies and from those who persecute me. Make your face shine upon your servant. Save me for your mercy's sake. Do not let me be ashamed, O Lord, for I have called upon you. Let the wicked be ashamed. Let them be silent in the grave. Let the lying lips be put to silence, which speak insolent things proudly and contemptuously against the righteous. Oh, how great is your goodness. It's an interesting phrase in the middle of Psalm 31. Are you thinking about the Lord's goodness when everything just seems to be crashing around you? Your goodness, how great is your goodness, which you have laid up for those who fear you, which you have prepared for those who trust in you in the presence of the sons of men. You shall hide them in the secret place of your presence from the plots of man. You shall keep them secretly in a pavilion from the strife of tongues. Blessed be the Lord, for he has shown me his marvelous kindness in a strong city. For I said in my haste, I am cut off from before your eyes. Nevertheless, you heard the voice of my supplications when I cried out to you. Oh, love the Lord, all you his saints. For the Lord preserves the faithful and fully repays the proud person. Be of good courage, and he shall what? Strengthen your heart, all you who hope in the Lord. Now, whether or not that's exactly what he wrote at that time in his life, but man, it fits. That he strengthened himself in the Lord. Just a couple other references. Psalm 86 and verse 5. Psalm 86, 5. For you, Lord, are good and ready to forgive and abundant in mercy to all those who call upon you. Psalm 86, 5. Psalm 100 and verse 5. For the Lord is good, his mercy is everlasting, and his truth endures to all generations. This is David, and this would be those kinds of things that you would call to mind to strengthen yourself in the Lord. Reminding yourself of the Lord is no doubt the best way to strengthen yourself in the Lord. To call to mind, I mean, here we are again, aren't we? We're right here again. In our brains, call to mind. I know everything's just terrible. It could not get any worse. But God. There's nothing that could be any more disastrous in my life. But the Lord doesn't change. He's the God of truth. He's the God who's so good. He's the God that's so merciful and loving and forgiving and abundant in grace and overflowing with loving kindness. I guess I'm fine. Everyone wants to kill me, but I'm somehow fine. God is still God. It's interesting in the New King James Version, in the Psalms, the word mercy is used 100 times. One of my favorites is Psalm 130 and verse 7. O Israel, hope in the Lord, for with the Lord there is mercy, and with him is abundant redemption. I love that because of what other translations, how they render it. In him is redemption in abundance. How you doing, David? Terrible. So I think I need to strengthen myself in the Lord. How do you do that? Call to mind what you know to be true. If that means calling other people, texting other, like, hey, can you pray for me? I'm not doing so hot. But it would seem that so much of this does come down to you and him. Like, no one else can strengthen you in the Lord for you. They can help with that. Thus the beauty and the importance of fellowship. But it's you and Him. He strengthened himself in the Lord. And then David said, verse 7, he said to Abiathar the priest, Ahimelech's son, please bring the ephod here to me. And Abiathar brought the ephod to David. And so David inquired of the Lord. It's almost like, finally. Finally, good job, David. So David inquired of the Lord, saying, shall I pursue this troop? Shall I overtake them? And he answered him, pursue, for you shall surely overtake them and without fail recover all. Like, this is the first recorded prayer of David since, chapter 23, I think. I might be wrong. You can check on that and correct me if I'm mistaken. But this is something like a year and a half later. Like, finally, David's inquiring of the Lord. And I love this because the Lord, his God, does what? He gave him direction. He answered his prayer. And David listened and then, of course, responded, verse 9, in this next big chunk here. So David inquired of the Lord, saying, or excuse me, that's verse 8. And the Lord responded, verse 9. So David went, he and the 600 men who were with him. They came to the brook Besor, where they stayed, or those stayed who were left behind. But David pursued, he and 400 men, for 200 stayed behind, for they were so weary that they could not cross the brook Besor. And that would make sense. They left the edge of battle to just go home, and it would have been quite a trek to go home, and you're probably just like, I can't wait to get home. It's great to see the family, get a bite to eat. There's no family. The city's burned to the ground, and now you're just weeping. You can understand their lack of physical strength there. So those who stayed were 200, and they couldn't cross the brook Besor. And verse 11, and they found an Egyptian in the field, and they brought him to David, and they gave him bread, and he ate, and they let him drink some water, and they gave him a piece of cake of figs and two clusters of raisins. So when he had eaten, his strength came back to him, for he had eaten no bread nor drunk water for 3 days and three nights. You understand this guy. Then David said to him, to whom do you belong, and where are you from? And he said, I am a young man from Egypt, servant of an Amalekite, and my master left me behind because 3 days ago I fell sick. Like, just interesting. No regard for human life, really, and yet they allowed the people of Ziklag to stay alive. This is curious. So he continues to tell the story here, this Egyptian slave. We made an invasion of the southern area of the Cherethites in the territory which belongs to Judah, and of the southern area of Caleb, and we burned Ziklag with fire. And David said to him, can you take me down to this troop? I'm just curious. So he said, swear to me by God that you will neither kill me nor deliver me into the hands of my master, and I'll take you down to this troop. Like, if you set me free and don't kill me, I will be happy to give you all the information you'd like to have, sir. When he had brought him down, there they were, these Amalekites, right? Spread out over all the land, eating and drinking and dancing because of all the great spoil which they had taken from the land of the Philistines and from the land of Judah. And then David attacked them from twilight until the evening of the next day. Not a man of them escaped except 400 young men who rode on camels and fled. They had a ride. So David recovered all that the Amalekites had carried away, and David rescued his two wives, and nothing of theirs was lacking, either small or great, sons or daughters, spoil or anything which they had taken from them. David recovered all. Notice verse 20, then David took all the flocks and herds that they had driven before those other livestock and said, this is David's spoil. Amazing. All is lost, except all is recovered. All is lost, and actually they now have more than when they started. Just this blessing that happens to be upon them. And there's just a few words that seem to summarize this whole chunk here from verse 9 to verse 20. Nothing is lost, and the three words, I think, of verse 19, David recovered all. Does that sound familiar? I mean, you're probably trying to think of, like, what's some application. How about if I ask it this way? Does that sound familiar in context? We just read it a few moments ago in verse 8. As the Lord responded to David's questions, pursue, for you shall surely overtake them and without fail recover all. God's promise comes to pass perfectly. It's all perfectly fulfilled. And David is involved in this work, and David gets to see it all come to pass. Now, David came to the 200 men, verse 21, who had been so weary that they could not follow David, whom they had also made to stay at the brook Besor. And so they went out to meet David and to meet the people who were with them. And when David came near the people, he greeted them. Then verse 22, then all the wicked and worthless men of those who went with David answered and said, and I wonder what their tone was, because they didn't go with us, we will not give them any of the spoil that we have recovered, except for every man's wife and children, that they may lead them away and depart. Interesting, isn't it? Not all of David's men were of the greatest character. They didn't do anything. We did all the fighting. Why would we? I'm fine, they can have their families. Great. But they don't get any of the stuff. David here interjects, and how this whole thing twists on victory, right? Like, this is not that long ago that all the men were like thinking, we need to kill David. And now he's back in charge. And there's victory, and all of a sudden, just kind of how fickle we are in our faith sometimes. Like, when things don't look good, we tend to turn on people that would be in charge. But David says in verse 23, my brethren, you shall not do so with what the Lord has given us, who has preserved us and delivered into our hand the troop that came against us. For who will heed you in this matter? But as his part is who goes down to the battle, so shall his part be who stays by the supplies, they shall share alike. And so it was, here's some commentary, verse 25, that from that day forward, he made it a statute and an ordinance for Israel to this day. What's the statute? What's the ordinance? It's really an important principle, actually. Both soldiers and supporters have a role to play and a work to perform. I was in the army. Infantry? No, I wasn't. But, you know, someone like, I worked on trucks. Okay, that's actually really, really important. It's actually a great New Testament principle, too. You find this in Philippians chapter 4, and just a casual read of the book of Philippians will tell you that so much of it is a thank you letter from Paul to the church in Philippi, where you find there, especially in chapter 4 of Philippians, the Philippian church had sent aid to Paul. It says, once and again for my necessities, you took care of me while I was a missionary. And then he said, not that I seek the gift. I'm not in it for the money. Not in it for the money, not in it for the gift, but I seek the fruit that abounds to your account. Well, no, Paul, no. You're the one preaching the gospel, not those people. But if they didn't send the money for him to go and do the missionary work, if they didn't support the work, guess what he wouldn't be able to do? Go and preach the gospel to anyone. It's missions. And missions is comprised of two things: missionaries and missions. It's supporters. Mission supporters. And they're both critical in the work of missions. There has to be something to do, but for the missionary to go and do the work, the mission work, if there's no support, best of luck to you. Like, it just doesn't work that way. Now, as for these wicked and worthless men mentioned there in verse 22, their issue was that these guys didn't go with us, so they don't deserve any of it. But did you catch David's retort in verse 23? Oh, what the Lord has given us. The Lord's delivered. The Lord has rescued us. He's taken care of all these things. He's given us all these victories. The Lord has given us these things. The Lord has given us even the spoil over and above that. So I understand your complaint about these people that didn't fight, but absolutely not. And it's the Lord the whole way. David's now in a place where, like, this was never about me. It's about the Lord and about His work being done and us submitting to that. No, what the Lord has given us. Now, when David, verse 26, came to Ziklag, he sent some of the spoil to the elders of Judah, to his friends, saying, here is a present for you from the spoil of the enemies of the Lord. And the next few verses here to kind of round out this chapter, this seems to be a simple thing. David works hard to give of what he has to, it would seem, to mend the relationships which have been, strained over the past plus or minus year and a half. So he sends these things to those, verse 27, who are in Bethel, those who are in Ramoth of the south, and those who are in Yatir, those who are in Aror, those who are in Sifmoth, those who are in Eshtemoa, verse 29, those who are in Rakal, those who are in the cities of the Yerameliites, those who are in the cities of the Kenites, those who are in Hormah, verse 30, those who are in Chorashan, those who are in Atach, those who are in Hebron, and all the places where David himself and his men were accustomed to rove. The Lord gave it, so I'm going to just send it along, and that's probably a lot of wisdom on David's part there. Try to mend some broken relationships. Meanwhile, so like this, there's like several parts to this. Time for battle. Okay, Saul doesn't know what to do, so he goes to the medium, right? David is and his men, they're in the procession getting ready to go, and the Philistines like, stop, no, these guys can't go. And while that's happening, the Amalekites are attacking Ziklag. So just, you guys need to go home, David, your men. So they get home, and there's this disaster. So, okay, Lord, should we go and track them down? You should. Here's this Egyptian guy. Like, if you keep me alive, I'll tell you. And so they have this great victory. David sends the supplies. Oh, yeah, there's still a battle. I'm like, oh, that's right. What about the battle? That's chapter 31. Now, the Philistines fought against Israel, and the men of Israel fled from before the Philistines and fell slain on Mount Gilboa. And the Philistines followed hard after Saul and his sons. The Philistines killed Jonathan, Abinadab, and Malchishua, Saul's sons. The battle became fierce against Saul. The archers hit him, and he was severely wounded by the archers. Of course, in chapter 28, when Saul had sought the medium and where the departed Samuel, assuming that's who it was, told him that both he and his sons would die. And this comes to pass. Saul, having already lost the throne, now loses his sons, who customarily would be heirs to the throne. And there's no other word for this other than tragic, right? This whole thing is so sad. And the practicality of this paves the way for the true king, for David. If any, you know, because Jonathan would be like, David's the king. I don't want it. Jonathan would have been a supporter, but no doubt there have been people that were like, David? That guy that's been with the Philistines? Like, no, Jonathan, you're the king. And maybe there would have been some discussion. And we don't know, because all the sons were dead. But had one of Saul's other sons stayed alive, guess what he would have done? Like, no, I'm the king. So this is really tragic. And of course, the word of the Lord comes to pass with all of this, and just Saul and it all being ripped from him. And it's just tragic, the human cost involved because of Saul being Saul through so much of his life and his rule. So Saul here, you notice there in verse 3, injured in battle by the arrow, or probably arrows, as there's archers just firing away. Then Saul said to his armor bearer, verse 4, draw your sword and thrust me through with it, lest these uncircumcised men come and thrust me through and abuse me. But his armor bearer would not, for he was greatly afraid, and therefore Saul took a sword and fell on it. Now, we're not told this in the text, but Jewish tradition, as I understand it, would tell you that his armor bearer was actually Doeg. We don't know that. It might have been that way, but we just don't know. This is an interesting thing, isn't it? He took his sword and he falls on it. The New King James says, lest they thrust me through and abuse me or torture me. So this isn't, and there's different commentators are going to go back and forth on this. This is not exactly suicide. Why not? Because he's dying. He's going to succumb to those wounds. So rather than the enemy come and do whatever they want to me and make it all the worse, I'm just going to take my life here quickly. I want to just hasten the process because I'm not going to survive this. As though he's some kind of medical expert, but I'm dying. It's hard. It's like this is the last decision of Saul. Try to convince someone else to kill him. Verse 5, and when his armor bearer saw that Saul was dead, he also fell on his sword and died with him. Which is also interesting. Like, there's nothing else for you to do, man? Is there anything else you... So Saul and his three sons, his armor bearer, and all his men died together that same day. Verse 7, when the men of Israel who were on the other side of the valley and those who were on the other side of the Jordan saw that the men of Israel had fled and that Saul had, and his sons were dead, they forsook the cities and fled, and the Philistines came and dwelt in them. So the Philistines are now occupying these cities. The people of their cities are realizing that our king's dead, the princes are dead, the army's fleeing. Like, we're toast. We better get out of here too. What's the expression? And it's a biblical one. You know, strike the shepherd and the sheep will flee, and it's kind of the leader's gone, and now what? There's no order. So the Philistines are now occupying these particular cities. So it happened, verse 8, the next day when the Philistines came to strip the slain, that they found Saul and his three sons fallen on Mount Gilboa, and they cut off his head, they stripped off his armor, and they sent word throughout the land of the Philistines to proclaim it in the temple of their idols and among the people. Then they put his armor in the temple of the Ashtoreths, and they fastened his body to the wall at Bethshan. And not much has changed in the past, you know, plus or minus 3,000 years. Just the cruelty and the mistreatment of bodies, even corpses. And all of this in this attempt to, it's like threefold, mock the king, mock Israel, and naturally with all the paganism, and to put the armor and the body and all these different things in these different places to mock the God of Israel. By the way, we're not told in the text here, but in 1 Chronicles chapter 10, we're told that Saul's head was sent to the temple of Dagon. Like, where are we going to put that? Let's offer that to Dagon. It's a side note here, but Bethshan or Bethshan, unless our itinerary has changed, we will see this on our tour of Israel in a few weeks, which is pretty remarkable. Also, yeah, we talked about that. The men without their leader, they flee. And so verse 11, when the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead, when they heard what the Philistines had done to Saul, all the valiant men arose and traveled all night and took the body of Saul and the bodies of his sons from the wall of Bethshan. They came to Jabesh or Yabesh, and they burned them there. And that, which of course is not a Jewish custom, but it could be they wanted to make sure they just completely got rid of the bodies so the Philistines couldn't do anything else with the bodies. It probably was their thinking. They took their bones and they buried them under the tamarisk tree at Jabesh and fasted 7 days. It's a little bit of a side note, but interesting, because Saul was often found under trees and his final resting place would be that. So why is Jabesh Gilead and those men, why is that important? Like, search your brains here a little bit. Is that where, was Saul from there? Or was that in chapter 11? That was the city which Saul years earlier had rescued. And they never forgot the bravery and the power and the might of their great king. And so they wanted to do this last honorary thing for their king that they respected so much, this man that delivered them and their families. And thus endeth the sad timeline and rule of Saul. Like, it's a tough 13-verse chapter there, but not much to it. Promise, like, your kingdom's gone. And even what Samuel spoke to him, your sons, this time tomorrow, you're all going to be dead. You're all going to be dead. And the mistreatment of the bodies, and it's just the whole thing, just so sad, just so tragic. And I guess what's also tragic, and we'll talk about this, so we officially finished, yay, we won't get into 2 Samuel next week, we'll have a discussion, but, you know, it's interesting because you read so much of this about Saul, and you think, man, so much potential, but he missed that potential, and there's a lot of wasted, lost potential, and Saul is sometimes doing great things, and sometimes less than great things, and you think, but there's always David. And you read David and think, yeah, David didn't get it right a lot of the time. Well, that was just, you know, because he was in such distress and everything. He had all these problems in his life. But, you know, when he became the king, then he got it right all the time, didn't he? It's amazing. And when you read through, even casually through the Old Testament, all of our great heroes, all of them, faults, all their failures along the way, all their sin along the way. And the last note, just leave you with this. When you get to the New Testament book of Hebrews, you get to chapter 11, you know, you never read about any of their faults, any of their failures, any of their sins. They live by faith. Yeah, but that guy did all these. He walked by faith. And aren't you glad that we're not going to get to heaven? Hey, Jeremy, how you doing? And everyone's going to be like, I know what that guy did. Like, that's just, that's, God is so gracious and merciful and long-suffering and forgiving, and why would he hear us? Because his character can't change. He's merciful, and it's redemption in abundance. Thanks for being here. Have a great night. See you Sunday.